religious diversity, and religion is another invisible identity. So just looking at this room, I can't really tell what your religious tradition or religious beliefs are. In many ways, you would have to self-identify that, but you don't have to. And if you think it'd be advantageous to identify, then you would probably do so. But if you think it would hinder you in society or in the workplace, you wouldn't disclose it. But there's also drawbacks to not disclosing it. What I want you to do is turn to a person next to you, and if you're comfortable doing this, share what religious tradition you're raised in. And then also, if you felt like you were ever discriminated against because of your religion, either explicitly or more kind of subtly, like you felt a certain level of stigma or misunderstanding associated with your particular religious tradition. So the religious tradition that you were raised in, whether or not you still self-identify with that religion, and whether or not you felt discriminated against or stigmatized because of your faith. So turn to pairs and share with each other. So I'm curious, as you read through the chapter, were there any things that stood out, either in your sense where you're like, oh yeah, with my particular religion, I felt like a minority in my community, or I never really thought that a certain percentage of the population was of this religious tradition, or, you know, were there things just that stood out?
I think it stood out to me that, or how many, it was the percentage of Jews was so little. I thought it was much bigger than they made up more of the population than they do.
Yeah. And so your general impression is that there's a higher proportion of Jewish people in the U.S. than 1%. I think it is between 1% and 2% is the proportion of the Jewish population. You're right, that is an interesting thing because, yeah, if you would just randomly poll people, you would probably get a higher number, they'd say 5 or 10% or even more, depending on what part of the country they live in. And part of it is maybe in different regions, there's a higher proportion of Jewish people, where in other places there's virtually none. But even Indiana, I wouldn't say is a large Jewish population.
I feel like there's a lot of Jews here.
But could that be, do you know where many of them are from? Like, is it from Chicago? Which would be a larger population of
Chicago
versus rural Indiana.
Right.
So in a lot of, I think the interesting thing is our perception of society and demographics is based on our social position. You know, one interesting thing for me is that the population of conservative Christians or conservative Protestants are among the least educated amongst the religious traditions. So the Jewish population is probably the highest educated, and then non-religious is pretty high, or atheist, but at the bottom is conservative Christians. And I always found that to be baffling because, you know, I would identify myself as a Christian, and I'm highly educated. Most of my friends are highly educated. And so I would think, oh, okay, they're highly educated. But if you look at the whole population across the country, you recognize, oh, there's a large proportion of conservative Christians that don't go to college. And then that actually shapes their interaction in the social world. You know, because I think a certain level of education brings a certain sense of liberal thinking, or at least critical thinking, that allows you to look at and engage differences, whereas if you're less educated, you're less exposed to other ways of thinking and other perspectives. So to me, it's always helpful to simply know the statistics and not let your own social position shape your perceptions of society, because that might be a misperception. Are there any other things related to this religion chapter that stood out to you, or that for you it either resonated with your own experience or it was a new insight? Yeah.
One thing, like when you talk about the lack of like diversity in churches, where it's like there's like white churches and black churches, and like they said, I think 1% of blacks attend white predominant churches. And that's exactly what I've experienced. I've grown up Christian, and I've gone to a lot of different churches. and it's pretty much been either all white or all black.
Mm-hmm. Any ideas why? I mean, it's very true. Yeah. Any ideas why?
No, not really. I think
yeah.
Because Christianity is kind of about being open and accepting.
Mm-hmm.
It's just weird that there's such a divide.
Mm-hmm. Does anyone have an idea why?
Oh, I had another point. I don't know why exactly.
What was your other point?
I thought it was interesting that, like, at your desk at work, you could have something promoting your own religion or religious freedom, as long as it was, like, small enough that only you could see.
Yeah.
But if it was big enough that anybody else could see, it wasn't okay.
Uh-huh.
So it's like, yeah, go ahead, practice your religious freedom, but don't make it big enough that anybody else can view it. Like,
yeah.
Just keep it to yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought that was kind of weird and ironic.
Well, and then also the subjectivity of how big is too big. Like
too
it's.
Big. But I mean, like, if it is too big, then you're possibly fired for it.
Yeah.
It's like, where's that line?
Yeah. This topic of religion is a very, I mean, even reading through the book, I kind of walk away from it like, so, you know, what was the term? Reasonable accommodations, but not with undue hardship. It's like, can you be more vague? You know, what is reasonable accommodation and what is undue hardship? Like, how do you find the balance of that? Trent, what was your...
I was just going to say about, like, the black and white churches.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've obviously grown up going to a white church, but I've been with a few friends to, like, their church. And just, like, the way that they worship and, like, this, you know, service goes is just so different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, you sit in a white church and it's, you know, it's calm. There's, you know, singing, things like that, and people get interactive, but... Then you go to a black church where it's like they're there and they're having fun. They're dancing around, like everyone's singing. It's not like old and young people are doing different things. Like they're
mm-hmm.
all just, there's so much, you know, energy going on.
Mm-hmm.
Then you go back to my church and it's like the old people, you know, they don't, you know, hardly even stand half the time
uh-huh.
to sing just because, you know, I don't know. But you know, I feel like you put a lot of those people that are uncomfortable, you know, with that in like the black church, that's why they kind of, separate. They just like to, you know, worship in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I have to admit, both of them were interesting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wouldn't not go back to either one, but it was just really weird. The first time I went, I was just like, you know, this is like, almost like a little party going on.
Uh-huh.
Everyone's dancing around. It was a lot of fun.
So, if the black church was, in some ways, more appealing, why didn't you continue going? If I was just going to do an assessment, I'd say, Trent, it seems like you prefer the black church,
yeah.
But why do you end up at the white church?
I usually just go with, like, my family,
uh-huh.
my parents, and they always go, you know, they've been going to the same church for a long time, so.
Sure.
That being said, you know, it's fun to get out and try new things, and,
mm-hmm.
but looking back, I mean, I still enjoyed my church overall more, because it has a lot more, you know, to, you know, offer me, but, you know, I wouldn't, you know, every once in a while, I would totally get
mm-hmm.
just to... If I'm feeling up for it and things like that.
Yeah, it was Martin Luther King Jr. who coined the term. He said, 11 a.m. on Sunday morning is the most segregated hour in America. And this was, you know, 40 years ago, but it's still the case. And I would argue on a couple levels that, one, a church or a religious congregation is a social organization. You know, there is a faith component to it, but it's also a social organization, just like other social organizations. And then added on to that is this phenomena of homophily, where we are drawn to and attracted people who are similar to us. And we actually avoid going to people who are different. So even, you know, I can relate to you, like the experience of being in a black church, it's, you know, at the end of the day, you're going to go to where your family is and where familiar, even though there's nothing inherently displeasing about the black church, is just the gravity and the pull towards the familiar. And, you know, I think I shared earlier in the semester my experience of I wanted to buck the system and go to a predominantly black church because I'm very cognizant of the fact that churches are very segregated. And if I care about diversity and racial equity, then I don't want to be contributing to reinforcing this separation. So I go to this black church, was involved with it for several years, but when I stepped back and looked at who my friends were, like who the people I actually had close interactions with, it was the other white people who joined that church. And actually, we had a lot in common because we were these presumably progressive white people who wanted to go to a predominantly black church. And so we had a lot in common, like in terms of homophily, there was a reason why we were friends with each other. And then even the black people that I was friends with, when I looked at who I was actually friends with, it was the African immigrants. So they weren't people who had grown up in the U.S., but they were African immigrants, and they are also grad students or highly educated people. And so again, there I was in a predominantly black environment, but I still gravitated towards the people in that community that were closest to my social profile. So it's hard to escape that. And religion in the U.S. has a very unique history. I mean, there's no other country in the world where religion has played out in the way it has in the U.S. And in many ways, it's a fascinating story, and it feeds into this idea of American exceptionalism. On many accounts, America is unique. It's not similar to other developed countries, and usually our closest comparison is the European nations. And on many levels, like with social welfare, we're unique in that regards, and in particular with religion, and how religion has sort of played out. And in many ways, religion has been on the decline in Europe for generations. I mean, it's clear secularization is predominant within the European countries, where religion is just on the decline, and everyone expected religion to be on the decline in America, in the U.S., but it just hasn't happened. It's just the levels of religiosity have been sustained. And a part of that is the origins of the U.S. And I think understanding religion in the U.S. today, in order to understand it, you need to understand the uniqueness of how religion was handled in the origins of our country. And there's a couple videos that I'm going to show that play out the history of religion in America, which I think are helpful in understanding where we are today and how it is kind of confusing this, you can exercise your religion but not impose it on other people, but also not be impeded from practicing your religion. It's this dance that we do where there's protections on both sides.
Each year, the President of the United States lights a national Christmas tree, hosts a Hanukkah party at the White House, and issues a proclamation honoring Ramadan, only in America. Indeed, America is known for religious tolerance. In fact, it is not an exaggeration to say that America, where people of all faiths are free to worship or not worship as they please, invented modern religious tolerance. This tolerance, which Americans take for granted, didn't exist anywhere in the world before America invented it. How did this happen? To answer that, we have to look to America's origins, which were overwhelmingly religious and, to be precise, overwhelmingly Christian. To put it another way, America became the religiously open nation that we know today because it was first a Christian nation, specifically a Protestant one. Let me explain. Until the beginning of the 16th century, religious life in Europe was dominated by the Catholic Church. All religious power was concentrated in the Pope and the Catholic clergy. They determined religious doctrine. The power structure was top down. All that changed in 1517 when Martin Luther, a German priest, led a revolt that came to be known as the Protestant Reformation. The theme of the Reformation was that people should be free to interpret the Bible and manage their houses of worship as they saw fit. A bottom-up power structure. The most zealous of England's reformers were known as the Puritans, so-called because they wanted to purify the Church of England. Some of these Puritans became so disenchanted, they decided they had no choice but to leave England. Only in the new world of America, untainted by European prejudices, could they practice their Protestant Christianity in its purest form. We know these hardy souls as pilgrims. The strength of their conviction can easily be measured by the incredible risks they took in crossing the North Atlantic on small wooden sailing ships, of which the Mayflower was only one. True to their religious background, these early settlers, and those that followed, were fiercely independent. Given that the Puritans believed that people should read and interpret Scripture for themselves, how could it be otherwise? Not surprisingly, it didn't take long before disputes broke out among the settlers regarding doctrine. In fact, the colony of Rhode Island was established in 1638 as a haven for some of these dissidents. Throughout the 17th century, more colonists arrived, including Catholics and Jews, but their numbers remained small relative to the Protestant majority. All the way through American independence in 1776 and the Revolutionary War that followed, Protestants remained dominant. But with more settlers came more religious discord. The only thing that everyone could agree on was that religion, specifically Christianity, firmly rooted, it's important to note, in the Hebrew Scriptures, was central to the new nation's life. When the colonies became states and wrote their state constitutions, they were noticeably Christian in their language and tone. But beyond that, there was little uniformity. Some states granted privileges to specific religions, while others expressed religious freedom for everyone. Delaware required an oath of office that professed faith in God and Jesus Christ. North Carolina prohibited any atheist or one who denied, quote, the truth of the Protestant religion, unquote, to hold office. A handful of states required office holders to be Christians. Some others required public officials to simply state they believed in God. On the other hand, five states prohibited clergy from holding office. This crazy quilt, anyone can interpret Scripture on their own, state by state, church by church, character of early American religious practice, which is both distinctly Protestant and uniquely American, led to the atmosphere of tolerance that was present at the founding of the nation. Indeed, it's enshrined in the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Given America's English and European roots, places where governments officially sanctioned one religion, this was a singular advance in human freedom. So, when the President of the United States lights a national Christmas tree, hosts a Hanukkah party at the White House, and issues a proclamation honoring Ramadan, we should thank those headstrong Puritans.
So overall, this video is good, but I feel it in many ways oversimplifies or paints too rosy of a picture, because there is religious tolerance in the U.S., and it is distinct, but it isn't to say that there's still harsh religious discrimination that occurs, or even a clear social hierarchy within the U.S. and within the religious traditions in the U.S. For example, there's only been one non-Protestant president of the United States, only one Catholic. President Kennedy was the only president who wasn't of a Protestant faith. And also, there's never been an atheist who's been a president of the United States. So, in a sense, if you look at the religious diversity of the U.S., and who leads, is the leader of the United States, it's always been a Protestant Christian. And in many ways, if you look at the religious hierarchy, it's the Protestants who are in control. And even within Protestantism, there's a hierarchy. So in a sense, this probably doesn't play out as much now, but the Episcopalians tended to be the wealthiest and the most educated amongst the Protestants. And they were the ones in positions of power. And then as you go down, you have Lutherans and Presbyterians, Methodists and Baptists, and it goes down. And in a sense, what would be described as high church, like the ones where you have more formal worship services, like in the Episcopal Church, they tend to be at the highest end of the hierarchy. And then the more open and free services, like the Baptist, where there's less hierarchy, is the lower end of the totem pole. But then if you go branch out beyond Protestantism, you have Catholic and Jewish, and then Eastern religions, Middle Eastern religions that are lower and lower on the totem pole. And so in many ways, we tout the fact that we're very religiously tolerant, but there's still a social hierarchy and there's still a power structure such that if you look at it closely, especially if you look at the U.S. Senate or the state legislature, you would see the same patterns of looking at the religious traditions of the leaders, and they're still predominantly Protestant. And again, it's a power issue of then what values should be endorsed and supported and which ones should be suppressed. And many of it is driven by this idea of xenophobia. And xenophobia plays out in any social setting where it's basically a fear of the other or someone that's different or strange. And I know for myself and all of us, we're influenced by this xenophobia where you just, if something's different or odd or strange or not normal, we tend to stay away from it and we also stigmatize it. I remember for me, you know, especially post 9/11, there was just this interest or intrigue with Islam, the Islam faith. And I just didn't know anything about it. I didn't have any friends who were Muslim. And so I went to a mosque and talked with the imam. I basically said, I don't know anything about Islam. You're a priest within this religious tradition. Tell me about Islam. And what was interesting for me was hearing the details of the faith tradition versus the sensationalized media reports of Muslim extremism. So to go into the mosque and to learn about some of the religious practices, to learn about the history, to learn about what it's like to be a Muslim in the U.S. post 9/11, which is very informative. And I know even on this campus, or actually just off campus, is a mosque less than a mile from here. And my sense would be that they would be tremendously welcoming to you if you came in and just said, hey, can I have an hour to just hear about what it is to be a Muslim and what it is to be a Muslim in Bloomington. The incident that happened last month with the Turkish woman getting verbally abused and attacked gives insight into religious tolerance isn't at the place that we'd want it to be. And so, you know, imagine if you were a person of the Muslim tradition walking around in Bloomington with a hijab, knowing that this woman just got attacked. And so then you sit there and say, well, should I hide my religion? Or what should I do? And so for us walking around, we don't even think about that. But again, someone of a religious tradition that is being stigmatized or targeted in unique ways makes it challenging. And it's even more challenging than in the workplace because you're thinking, are my opportunities for advancement or promotion affected because of my religious tradition? So then the uniqueness of religion in America goes back to the First Amendment. And the First Amendment is a very powerful amendment in regards to freedoms in general, but in particular, religious freedom. And I think it's helpful to know what is the First Amendment and how does it apply to our contemporary situation. So what are the origins of it, and then how does it apply to the workplace and in civic life? So there's a quick explanation of what is the First Amendment.
The First Amendment protects our freedom of religion, but it doesn't say anything about how a group in the U.S. legally goes from being an organization to being a religion. So how does that work? Well, the short answer is it doesn't. There's no actual way for the U.S. government to legally recognize a religion. But Tara, with Hobby Lobby, the Supreme Court said, no, let me explain. The First Amendment states that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. So outside of acknowledging that religions exist, the amendment doesn't give the government the power to do anything. It just gives them the obligation to not do things, namely establish or prohibit religion. By implication, it also prevents the government from elevating any one religion over another, because that would count as establishing one religion and by extension, prohibiting another. So they can't even make a list of approved religions, which begs the question, how can you protect the rights of something you can't officially recognize? That's the thing about the U.S. Constitution. It's designed to protect the rights of U.S. citizens, including their freedom of religion, but it's not designed to protect their specific religion, and it's definitely not designed to protect their religious institution. It's the difference between protecting someone's belief in Catholicism and protecting the Catholic Church. You see, the Supreme Court sees religion as a sincere and meaningful belief that occupies in the life of its possessor a place parallel to the place held by God in the lives of other persons. And that is what the freedom of religion protects, your right to believe and practice whatever religion you want. If an organization is using those beliefs and practices to form a religion, that's fine. But it's those beliefs and practices that are being protected, not that religious organization. So there's no legal official way to become religion, but there doesn't have to be. All religious beliefs, big or small, are protected. So pray on, prayer.
So the First Amendment, you know, I've had to read it multiple times to figure out what exactly it's saying, and it helps to know the context in which it was written. So the First Amendment in regards to religious freedom has two pillars. And the first is freedom from religion. So and what that means is when they were writing the Constitution and the amendment, they were writing in a context of coming from nations where there was an official state religion, the Church of England, or where the Catholic Church was the supreme authority. And in the United States, they wanted to have that no particular religion would be the established religion, but that there would be freedom from religion, that there would be no authority above you saying, this is the religion that you must practice or else you can't be a citizen. And so there's a separation of the church and the state. What's interesting with this is that the writers of the Constitution, all of them, my understanding is that all of them were Protestants. And when they were thinking about religious freedom, freedom from religion, it was that there wasn't going to be any one particular denomination that was going to be the state religion, the state Protestant religion. What they didn't fathom, but I think it actually applies, is that there's tremendous variation and variety of religious traditions, but the principles still hold, that there'd be no one religion that would be established. And so what that also means is that the government couldn't sort of single out, and this is back in the day, they couldn't single out, let's say, Presbyterians as being the privileged religion of a particular state or community. Like, they couldn't do anything that would particularly benefit or single out one particular religion. And again, they were thinking in the context of Protestant denominations. What it shifted to be is the times when the U.S. tries to single out or privilege Christianity. So, and this is where there's a lot of debate and conflict, is that people will say, well, the U.S. is a Christian nation, so Christianity should be privileged over all other religions. And then people turn to the First Amendment and they say, well, no, actually it says that no one religion should be established or should be set apart as being the state religion. Back then it was particular denominations. Now it's whether it should be Christianity or Judaism or Islam. So the principles still hold, maybe not in the way that the writers of the Constitution intended, because they were thinking in the context no one particular Christian denomination should be established, but now it's sort of spread to no particular religious tradition should be established. Either way, the First Amendment is freedom from religion, that the government should not endorse or support any one particular religion. That's just what the Constitution is. That's unique to the U.S. In other countries, it's very clear that the government endorses and supports and privileges a particular religion. In the U.S., that's not how we're organized. The second pillar of the First Amendment with regards to religious freedom is freedom for religion, or freedom to practice your religion, so that no one can come in and say, can inhibit you or impede you from practicing your religion. So not only can no one from top down say this is the religion that you must practice, but then also whatever religion I choose, I have the freedom to practice that religion. And even what the video talked about is that basically the government has to be hands off. They can't impose religion and they can't impede religion. And then this translates into the workplace in similar ways, but it gets more complicated because an organization is a private organization, and so they're not the government, they're not necessarily imposing a particular religion or impeding religious practice. And so your question of can you, you know, have a placard in your cubicle that allows you to practice your religion, but in a way that it doesn't impose on coworkers. And that's sort of the dance that they're trying to make, is that not inhibiting my religious practice, but also not in a way that's going to impose my religious belief on others in the workplace. And there's no real clear line, and it almost seems like it has to be case by case. And even in the case studies we read, it went both ways. Sometimes it was viewed as imposing your religion on others, and other times it was viewed as my religious practice is were being impeded or prevented. A couple of terms that are helpful to know, whether it's regard to the workplace or just religion in general, is that religiosity is the extent to which a person practices their religion. So, you know, on a survey, you'd be asked, what's your religious tradition? And you would maybe put down Methodist, or you put down Christian, or whatever the category that fits best. But if 10 people put down that same answer, there's probably 10 different levels of religiosity, of how devout they are. So some people would be at one end where they're extremely devout, and when they put down Christian, it's like their central identity, it's the central marker and anchor of who they are and how they live out their life. And for another person, it's like, well, I'm not Muslim and I'm not Jewish, and so I guess I'm Christian, or I was raised Christian, but the daily relevance or implications it has to my life is virtually non-existent. And maybe even a year from now, when I fill out the survey, I'm going to not put Christian, I'm going to put no religion. You know, it's sort of just a vestige of your upbringing, and that just the relevance to your life is no longer apparent. And I would describe those people as culturally religious, or like cultural Christian or cultural Jew. Like you still have the culture associated with that religious tradition, but the personal faith practice and daily living out of that faith tradition is no longer there. It's just the culture that's still there. The culture is still important, but it's not necessarily religious faith being practiced. And so it's a very complicated thing, because you could have a large percentage of the population identifying as being Christian, but to me, the real question is, what's your level of religiosity? How important is your faith to you? How devout are you in practicing it? Some of the more extreme cases, and one of you asked, like, what is fundamentalism and what is a fundamentalist? And a fundamentalist, from a Christian perspective, is someone who it emerged in the early 1900s of basically saying, we take the Bible literally, like the fundamentals of the Christian faith, we're going to enforce and uphold. And it also plays out in Islamic fundamentalism, basically where you take everything literally and to an extreme. So fundamentalism is basically just taking things to an extreme and having a very rigid view of that particular belief system and not seeing any other options. Some of the things that are interesting with the U.S. and with religion that stand out to me is how religion is privileged. Like we talk about, there's no federal protection for homosexuals, employment discrimination, but there is for religion. And people are like, why should someone be protected, their religious tradition be protected, but not their sexual orientation? That just doesn't seem equitable. But a lot of it is the history of the U.S. being a very religious nation. And some of the things of protections for religion, like on the U.S. Census, you will not be asked, you've never been asked, what's your religious tradition? It's because it's this freedom from the government imposing on how you're going to practice your religion or what religion you're going to practice. Also, churches are exempt from paying taxes. So again, this separation of the church and the state. Even congregations don't even have to file with the IRS. So if you wanted to know the average annual revenue of churches in the U.S., it's really hard to know, because there's no IRS tax filings of how much they make. If you're a minister, an ordained minister, you get the money that you spend on housing is tax deductible. So if you spend, let's say, $30,000 a year on your housing as a minister, you get a tax deduction from it. There's no other vocation in which the U.S. government gives deduction for housing. So there's this tradition of privileging religion, and arguably people would say, why? Why do we still do that? You know, what if you're the director of a nonprofit organization? Shouldn't you be eligible for this deduction in housing expenses? So there's a lot of things woven into the history of religion in America that gives it a special privilege. to me, religion in the workplace is a confusing dynamic because you have the Christians who are the ones who are presumably the ones in power, but their power is eroding, and it's a much more religiously pluralistic society. And so then how are we navigating these new religious perspectives, and more so, the people who are non-religious? So it's a growing population of people who don't even claim any religious tradition. It's sort of like if you looked at race or any other social category, if there was a group that was aracial, like no race, like, okay, how does that fit into the social hierarchy? So there's uniqueness about religion that makes it much more complicated, and it's something that you can switch in and out of. You can start off as one particular religion and then switch into another religion or switch into no religion at all, which is very different than most other social categories that are more inherent to who you are. So there's another clip that PBS put together, a documentary, very fascinating, of just sort of what the, again, religion in America and the uniqueness of that.
Coming this fall to PBS. For those who know that in America, religion matters, and those who wish it didn't matter so much, comes a sweeping history of how religious faith has shaped America.
We Americans are persistently religious. We are incurably religious.
This fall, God in America examines 400 years of the country's enduring quest for religious liberty and its impact on society, politics, and the spiritual experience of Americans.
That noble idea passed on from generation to generation, the God-given promise that all are equal, all are free, and all deserve a chance to pursue their full measure of happiness.
This is this great conversation we've had from the very beginning of American life. We've had this notion that this is a special place, and what makes it special is that we have some kind of special relationship with God.
It is the story of how Europeans' attempt to convert Native Americans was met with violent rebellion. How the Puritans fled religious tyranny in the Old World.
We must consider that we shall be as a city upon the hill.
To build a more perfect society in the new.
You are to be banished. The ideal was to have a single, pure, orthodox community in which everybody conformed to the true religion.
How born-again Baptists joined with Thomas Jefferson to forge a new religious liberty.
Jefferson said, I couldn't disagree with you more about the substance of all of this, but I will defend your right to say it.
How Catholic immigrants demanded their freedom from Protestant domination.
Hughes genuinely felt that the public schools were engines of converting Catholics into Protestants.
The religious rights of my flock should not be filched away from them.
How waves of newcomers changed the face of religion, and how America changed them.
The purpose was to unite American Jews under the banner of Reform Judaism and American Judaism.
And how the American experiment created the competitive religious marketplace that thrives today.
There is this new style now, this new spiritual but not religious style.
You can't divorce faith from the American experience. It really is our historical and cultural DNA. We still are the children, the descendants of Jamestown and Plymouth Rock.
God in America is the dramatic history of the struggle for faith and freedom, rewritten by war, by politics, and by spiritual imagination.
Slavery is a divine institution, say the people of the South.
It is the story of faith and the Civil War.
Slavery is a satanic evil institution, say many in the North. Both sides believe that God is with them.
And the president's private spiritual journey.
God wills this contest.
Lincoln decided that the war had been decreed by God. He had no choice but to see it through to its fruition.
Of the religious foundation of civil rights and the faith of a visionary leader.
I just want to do God's will, and He has allowed me to go up to the mountain.
the story of revolution.
This is righteous, and God is with us in this cause.
And the battle between faith and evolution.
The only purpose Mr. Darrow has is to slur at the Bible. I'm examining you on your fool ideas that no intelligent Christian on earth believes.
It is a story of spiritual awakenings.
I bless the Lord. He hath let me see which was the clear ministry and which the wrong.
And political awakenings.
I know that you can't endorse me, but I want you to know that I endorse you.
They began to see it as a way to win elections. We began to see winning elections as a way to make our country a better moral place.
Of the freedom to believe and the struggle to be free from belief.
The Supreme Court is saying that atheists have the same protections that other minorities have.
Of the quest for truth, faith, and power in the most religiously diverse nation on earth.
We are a nation of Christians and Muslims, Jews and Hindus, and non-believers.
It is a complex history full of surprises and insights, a fresh and challenging journey through the American story, a story you are not likely to see the same way after watching God in America, a special series coming this fall from Frontline. Experience.
So when you trace the history of religion in America, it's very complicated, and I think where it gets really complicated is when religion becomes politicized. And you know, there's the one clip where it said that basically using religion to win elections, but also using the government to advance the objectives of your religion. And I think that's where it becomes, for me, very complicated, because for me, religion has always been a personal endeavor, and it informs my value system and how I view diversity and how I view social equity. Like, it informs a lot of those things, but it seems to get tainted or tarnished when it becomes politicized. And especially in the U.S., there's, and especially amongst Christians, of saying that, you know, well, the founding fathers were Christians, and this is a Christian nation, and we need to retain this being a Christian nation. But when you look deeper into the history, it's not as clear cut as that. You know, one thing that I find really fascinating is a lot of the things that are seem to have these Christian roots of over 200 years are actually new developments just in the last 50 years. Most of you probably grew up, or maybe you did, saying the Pledge of Allegiance. How many of you said the Pledge of Allegiance? So, the Pledge of Allegiance wasn't written until 1892. It was actually, you know, fairly long time ago. But it wasn't until 1954 that the phrase, one nation under God, was added. So it was always one nation indivisible. It wasn't one nation indivisible under God. The under God part was added in the 1950s by Eisenhower. And basically, it was added in response to socialism and communism and the communist threat that was emerging. And communism sort of is founded on atheism. That's one of the premises of socialism. And so to react to that and to sort of establish, hey, no, this is, we're one nation under God, that was put in. Also, if you look at your dollar bill, it says, in God we trust. Again, that was something that wasn't on U.S. currency bills until the 1950s. Now, it was on coins for some reason earlier, but it basically established that all U.S. currency would have that starting in 1956. Olivia.
And so why did they add the under God phrase?
Well, my understanding is that Eisenhower and others were, is right after World War II, the Soviet Union had been established, and there was this worldwide threat of communism spreading. And so there was the Red Scare, where people who were thought to be sympathetic to the socialist movement were outed as a witch hunt. And so basically to affirm, solidly affirm that we are God-fearing, God-believing nation, that was one way to signal that, is my understanding of why that was put into the Pledge of Allegiance and into the U.S. currency. Well, to me, what's interesting is that it's a fairly recent phenomenon. It wasn't since day one of the United States, this was part and parcel of who we are as a nation. Now, clearly, the majority of people who established the U.S. were Christian, But I don't know if they sort of had the intentions of having to be a Christian nation in the ways that it is highly politicized today as being a Christian nation. I don't think you can make that direct link. And so then you have religion in the public sphere, which is focusing on my personal life and my freedom of exercising religion. And then you have religion in the workplace, and that's where it gets more complicated. On Thursday, we're going to talk about the things related to RFRA, which is the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, from the religion perspective, not the sexual orientation perspective, and also Title VII as it applies to religious practices and freedom. Organizations like Hobby Lobby and Chick-fil-A and other workplace environments that have certain religious orientations that they're wanting to promote or not promote. But I think in helpful in knowing religion in the workplace, it's important to know that it's religion in the workplace in the U.S. context, because that's what makes it unique, because religion in America is unique. And also on Thursday, I'm going to dedicate time for you guys to talk about your projects. So if between now and Thursday you have questions related to the progress or development of your diversity audit project, come up with those questions, and I'm just going to have time where I'm going to make myself available to answer any questions. If you're wondering, okay, what should the presentation involve, and what does the write-up need to include, and do we have enough data, and any questions or concerns you have about the project, I'm going to set aside time on Thursday to address those. That's all.